the award-winning Your Financial Editor program on 930 WFMD. News from the worlds of business and finance with Your Financial Editor, Chris Murray.
Welcome to another edition of the Your Financial Editor program right here on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com and as a podcast. Just go to Apple Podcast and you can grab the Your Financial Editor program there. Good program for you today. I think you might want to re-listen to it. It's going to be entertaining, insightful, informative. So we've got some really good top stories, quite a bit of economic data this past week, including the big jobs report that came out yesterday. So we'll be talking about all that. And then joining me, a friend of the program. It's been like 12 or 13 years, I think, since we last spoke here on the program. But joining me, Mr. Lou Ferrante. Lou is a former Gambino crime family captain. So he was neck deep in the mafia, convicted of his crimes, did 8 years in prison. While in prison, reformed himself, learned to read, taught himself how to write correctly, and basically came out and, with permission of the families, basically was allowed to tell his story while in the mafia and also write books about it. And he's on his so we talked to him, his first book, Mob Rules, like I said, I think it was 12 or 13 years ago, here on the program with me. And then his latest is Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. So we're going to talk about what Lou's been up to the last decade or so, talk about what's going on with his works, and also what's going on today with the mafia. You know, it originated back in Sicily, had quite an empire here, was disassembled by America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, where he put his own people away. And, you know, and then basically get an update. What's it like now? A lot of competition from the Chinese, the Jamaicans, MS-13, you know, you name it, the Chechnyans. There's a lot of gang activity here in America these days, and they're all competing for the same dollar. So we'll be talking about all that, how it impacts the economy, things of that nature. So settle in, get another cup of coffee or a soda, whatever, you know, get another ice cold water, whatever suits your fancy, and enjoy the program. Had a big deal this week that was announced, again, in the energy sector. That's where we've been seeing these deals for the last 9 months. In particular, the oil field services company SLB said on Tuesday it was going to buy a smaller rival, Champion X, in an all-stock deal valued at $7.75 billion. As you continue to see this consolidation in the North American energy sector. So oil service providers have followed energy producers in pursuing deals as they navigate operational and pricing challenges, while also catering to customers who have cut spending on new wells. So this is SLB's biggest purchase since 2016, when it bought the it was an oil field gear maker called Cameron International. So nice big deal there. Like I said, $7.75 billion. SLB expects to have a pre-tax annual savings of about $400 million in the first 3 years after the deal closes. So, you know, these guys are at war with this administration, the traditional, reliable, dependable, economical energy that is available to not just Americans, but, and really, more importantly, the world. I mean, you're talking about energy that's needed to keep incubators on to save precious lives of little babies. And they're at war because of this this whole sham of climate change and money laundering. And it's all about power and control and it's costing people lives. So these energy companies are having to fight and fight hard against this administration and its lackeys out there that are pushing this false narrative. We also got some bad news for some employees. They work at Citigroup. Citigroup announced they were going to lay off 430 employees. They talked about that on Monday when they disclosed a filing with the State Department of Labor. The bank last week ended a sweeping overhaul, its biggest in decades, as part of an effort to simplify its structure and try to improve performance at the bank. You know, they talked about trimming their global workforce by 20,000 people over the next 2 years. So this latest 430 pink slips, that announcement was the latest that we've heard from them so far. Also a top story, we heard from Jerome Powell this week. So he was at a Q&A session at Stanford University. He was reading his prepared remarks on Wednesday and basically admitting that the Fed can't do anything right now because inflation is still here. It's still sticky. And then, of course, the jobs numbers, which I'll get to that jobs report I mentioned at the top of the program in just a little bit, is a burr in their britches too. So Powell said that the Fed's job is not done yet. As far as inflation, it's too soon to say whether the recent readings represent more than just a bump. According to Powell, we do not expect that it will be appropriate to lower their policy rate until they have greater confidence that inflation is moving sustainably down to 2%. This is going to be a real problem for them unless they start messing with numbers or, like I mentioned months and months and months ago, they change their bogey. They move the goalpost from 2% inflation to, you fill in the blank, 2.5, 3, whatever it might be. The problem is the further we get into 2024, the tighter the pressure is on Powell. The Federal Reserve, the central bank, says they're not political. That's not true. They are. We saw Powell do a terrible job with inflation the last couple of years because he was trying to get reappointed by Biden and didn't want to be raising interest rates. So, you know, people make their deal with the devil and then they live with it. And in the whole period of time since then, you've seen American workers being crushed by inflation because they didn't get out ahead of it. And then by the time he started messing with interest rates and was very aggressive, the horse wasn't only out of the barn, it was out of the state. So, like I said, it's going to be fun to watch these guys squirm and these prepared remarks where they talk to you like you're an idiot and you can't read the tea leaves. You know, talking about inflation, energy prices, and I spoke about that deal just a little while ago, energy prices continue to escalate. So we saw more pressure on oil. Brent crude hit over $90 a barrel this week. These are some of the highest levels we've seen since October. Again, the Fed's trying to make this argument that they can cut interest rates, not when you've got these commodities that continue to go up in price, right? So you've got oil prices going up. Why, by the way? Because of these asinine policies by this administration that is just crushing Americans and really other people around the world who could be receiving even more of our exported energy. You also have what's going on in Israel, right? So people are worried about that part of the world because so much energy and other products are transferred, you know, through that area. So is that going to be an issue? You saw this this week where you had some Ukrainian drone strikes on refineries in Russia, and that's going to cause more disruptions, you know, there for energy. And at the same time, our good friends at OPEC, right, those countries that just love us, they had a meeting this week, and they voted to keep their bans in place as far as those production cuts that they had talked about. They're leaving them there. So, and not to make things worse, but if you want to, here's some salt pushed into the wound. The Biden administration has canceled a plan that they just announced last month to purchase up to 3 million barrels of oil, which is a spit in the ocean, as I said, as part of their effort to refill the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, SPR. So that was established by Congress years and years ago for emergency situations. Emergency situations. God forbid we would have one. So what does this administration do? They play politics and they start taking those reserves out and putting them into the market to try to push gasoline prices down the last 2 years. It's a 43% decline from January of 2021 when you look at our Strategic Petroleum Reserve for emergencies. And like I said, this was all done politically. So this is terrible. Their whole policy is terrible, hurtful, deadly to some, which I just want to remind everybody. You hear these people talking about, oh, what's going in and going on, excuse me, you know, in Southern Africa and all these places, and it's climate change and the heat, you know, global warming, and the heat is going to kill. Guess what? The cold kills more people than heat. So if you don't have reliable energy to keep you warm, forget it. But they don't want to talk about that because it's a false narrative. It's like we talked about recently with my guest, Dr. LeGates. It's all control. And, you know, by the way, he has his PhD in climatology. But it's all control. It's all power. It's money. They're money laundering. You know, picking winners and losers at literally life and death decisions for people here and around the world. So when we look at the economic data of this week, there's a lot of it. So U.S. construction spending unexpectedly fell in February. The Commerce Department came out at the beginning of the week and said that construction spending dropped 0.3%. Economists that were polled by Reuters were looking for a 0.7% gain. So that was a massive miss. I mean, that's just one piece, but, you know, that was not a good piece of data that we saw. Now, we did see factory orders actually increase 1.4%. That was after minus 3.8% in January. That was revised lower. So, you know, just some mixed data, which is par for the course, right? I mean, that's the kind of stuff we get. When we look at the big ISM reports that we got, U.S. manufacturing grew for the first time in 1.5 years in the month of March. So the survey from the Institute for Supply Management, the ISM manufacturing report, which has just been crushed by these higher interest rates, finally got above 50. So what we saw for a reading in March was 50.3. That's the highest and first reading above 50 since September of 2022. So boy, did we need that, because that's just been in the gutter for a long time. Then when we look at the ISM non-manufacturing survey or services survey, that actually slipped. So that went from a reading of 52.6 to 51.4 in March. Economists were looking for a stronger number. They were looking for 52.7. obviously, not only was it, you know, below the prior month, but it was below the estimate from economists that were polled by the Wall Street Journal were looking for. So if you look for the glass half full for both of these reports, anything over 50 is growth. Anything below 50 is contraction. So, you know, the 50.3 for manufacturing, the 51.4 for, and by the way, that's 0 to 100. the 51.4 for services, which were a service-based economy. Nothing at all to write home about, but as I said, if you're glass half full, it's at least above the 50 mark for both of those. You know, fortunately, it's not below it. I mean, that's just the bottom line. We saw mortgage rates, you know, increased a little bit this week. So even though interest rates are going up, and obviously they're higher not only than last week, but then a year ago, you still have people that are trying to, you know, get themselves into a home. It's becoming tougher and tougher. There was a report out this week that I saw that showed in all 50 states, it's actually cheaper to rent than to own. Remember, it used to be just the opposite. And obviously, most people you meet, they want to buy, you know? A man's house is a man's castle. A lady's house is a lady's castle. You know, the whole deal. People want to own. And because of all of this inflation, a lot of it in housing, of course, and that's a big component of the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which, by the way, we're going to get next week. So that'll be interesting to see what they show us there. But, yeah, it's, you know, it's a tough market out there with these interest rates. And this week they were moving higher, and that's not what we want. But because of inflation, you see the bond market reading those, you know, those the skyline, if you will, figuring out what's what. And that's why you see this movement in these treasuries and the bond market in general. So it was a big week for jobs. We got a lot of data. It started the middle of the week when we got the job openings and labor turnover survey. It's referred to as the JOLTS report, and the JOLTS, that's an acronym for, again, job openings and labor turnover survey. That comes from the Labor Department. It showed that there were 1.36 vacancies for every unemployed person in February. So a lot of openings out there. Actually, job openings edged up 8,000 in February to 8.756 million job openings. The number of workers resigning from their jobs, likely for greener pastures, increased by 38,000 in February. And according to the JOLTS report, layoffs increased 128,000 in February. That was the highest level in the JOLTS report in about 11 months. So we continue to see the jobs information all over the place for sure. Then we got the ADP report. So according to ADP, employers added 184,000 workers in March. That was above expectations. The expectation was 150,000. That 184,000 increase was the largest since July and was led by gains in leisure and hospitality, 63,000 jobs added in leisure and hospitality. Not your highest paying jobs, right? But that's where ADP, the private report, saw the biggest movement, if you will, in the jobs market. Then, of course, as we do every week, we got the initial jobless claims. Initial jobless claims increased to a two-month high last week. So the expectation was we were going to have 214,000 new claims last week. Instead, we got 221,000. So 9,000 more people showing up in the line to collect unemployment benefits. And by the way, no big surprise, the previous week showed 2,000 more applications than what the Labor Department originally you know, gave us. And then you look at the Challenger Job Cut Report. It's actually Challenger Gray and Christmas Report. And it showed that there were 257,254 jobs cut in the first quarter of 2024. The tech industry accounted for over 42,000 of those. So that was the biggest industry as far as job layoffs go. So, you know, that's something you don't want to see. But we've been talking about it for months and months, you know, whether it's Dell or IBM or Amazon or whoever. The tech sector has really been getting rocked when it comes to layoffs, for sure. And then we get the big jobs report yesterday. If you want to believe it, I take it as a grain of salt. I don't think the Labor Department higher-ups have any credibility whatsoever. But the Labor Department said that 303,000 jobs were added in March. The expectation was about 200,000. So 303,000. The unemployment rate actually went up from 3.8 to 3.9. Also, it wasn't good wages, which, you know, you consider them an important metric for inflation pressures. They were only up 4.1% year over year, their lowest annual gain since June 2021. So, again, people having such a hard time keeping up with inflation, for sure. And, you know, the jobs report has, you know, two different components, two different surveys. You know, you have the business side of it. You have the household side of it. They told different stories. The other thing was that I did not like, once again, about the jobs report, 72,000 jobs in healthcare. Now, healthcare is important. I'm all about it. When I need it, I love it that it's there. But I also know that the government is way too involved in healthcare, way too involved. So, you know, when I see that 72,000 jobs were added in that area, I wonder, right? I question what that's really all about. What was the second biggest? Government employees at 71,000. So you've got healthcare, which the government's way too involved in. And then you've got just more big government, which is the opposite of what we need. So 72,000 jobs added in healthcare, 71,000 jobs added in government. These are not good reports. They just aren't. But, you know, we'll continue to watch it and call it out, tell you the truth, and then you can make you know, a decision as far as what you believe, what you don't believe. I mean, we all know how we feel, even though people tell us, don't believe your lying eyes, right? Which I just can't believe how good these people are at lying and how they have absolutely no remorse but to stare in the camera and lie. So, but that's the deal, right? That's what we have to work with these days. So I'm going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with my guest. Looking forward to it. Lou Ferrante is going to be joining me again. Hasn't been on for like 12-13 years, maybe. He was former Gambino family mafia captain and did his time in the Slammer, and has I think a new book out along with updated information on today's modern mafia. Stay tuned. Are you ready? Are you ready? Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD at WFMD.com and as a podcast. Just go to Apple Podcasts. You can grab it there. Thanks so much for being with us today. I hope your weekend's going well. As I mentioned before the break, really looking forward to a conversation. Old friend of the program, Mr. Lou Ferrante. He was on years ago after his first book. I learned about it, and Lou came on a couple times, and we talked about it. And it was very successful, and he's had a very successful life since then. So I'm really glad to have Lou back on the program. And, you know, we've got a lot of new listeners. Look, we started the program in 1990, the program, I founded it in 1997, have been hosting it ever since. So we've got people, you know, some OGs and also new people today. So as you know, we talk about pretty much everything under the sun and how it impacts business and finance and you know, so many areas of our lives, our families. So with that, I'd like to bring in our guest, Mr. Louis Ferrante. Hey, Lou, how are you?
Good, very good, Chris. Thanks for having me again, and congratulations on your continued success.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. Thank you. So for, you know, the folks that may have forgotten that we're around, and then, of course, for all the new folks, give them some background on yourself, and then we'll get into your latest book, which we're looking forward to.
Sure. In a nutshell, I grew up in Queens. I started out as a very young, early teens, as a car thief. I eventually ran a chop shop, an automobile chop shop, and sold parts to collision shops. I graduated to hijacking at some point. And then I ran a crew within the Gambino crime family of hijackers. We did heists and hijackings. And at some point in 1994, I was hit with 3 indictments. The Secret Service indicted me, the FBI indicted me, and the Nassau County Organized Crime Task Force. And I was facing the rest of my life in prison. I hired the best attorneys money could buy at the time. I was able to plead guilty and get a 13-year sentence, which was better than a life sentence if I had gone to trial and risked it and rolled the dice. I did not cooperate, nor did my co-defendants. In that time, while I was away, I picked up my first book. I fell in love with reading. I had never read a book from cover to cover before in my life. And I became an avid reader, and I began to teach myself everything that I had neglected to learn while I was on the streets. And when I came home from prison, I became a writer. And by the grace of God, I've been very successful at it. My last book, Mob Rules, which is probably the one we spoke about last time, is now an international bestseller in 20 languages. And the new book, Borgata, Rise of Empire, I was in Sicily on a speaking engagement, and I bumped into Lord George Weidenfeld, one of the most famous and prolific publishers of the 20th century. He published great books like Crick and Watson's The Double Helix, the memoirs of Pope John Paul II, the memoirs of Charles de Gaulle, etc., Moshe Dayan, Lyndon Johnson, and he asked me to write a history of the mafia, and I guess it was an offer I couldn't refuse as I was sitting there in Sicily with him in Agrigento overlooking the ruins. I picked up the pen and started to write. Since he commissioned that project, unfortunately, he passed on. I did dedicate the first volume to him, but it morphed into a 3-volume trilogy, a trilogy of the American mafia beginning in Sicily, and it takes us up through volume 1, goes from the 1860s in Sicily up and through the Kennedy administration in 1960. And it has a lot to do with business. It shows how the mob sort of embedded themselves in American industry in so many different ways. They took over labor unions. They became the biggest labor racketeers. A lot of Italians partnered with Jews in infiltrating labor. And also during Prohibition, there were a lot of Jewish gangsters that partnered with the Italian mafia. And they eventually just really bought politicians as they went along. A lot of politicians across America, both parties, had their hands out, so the mob was easily able to infiltrate political institutions as well across America, whether it be local or the ones in Washington. So they really, really chose how it's really the volume 1 of the Borgata trilogy is a deep dive into the first 100 years of the mafia, what I would consider the mafia's golden age. It focuses on a lot of different biographical characters, such as Lucky Luciano, Frank Costello, Vito Genovese, Albert Anastasia, Maya Lansky, Lepke Bukalta, Arnold Rothstein, and I go through all of their different lives as they come in and out of the larger sort of canvas. And so far, the reviews have been phenomenal. The Wall Street Journal covered it. The New York Times had a brief mention. The Washington Free Beacon had a rave review. A New Jersey magazine recently gave me a rave review. So luckily, once again, thank God, the book is doing really well, and hopefully it does as good as Mob Rules, my international bestseller.
Yeah, for sure. So one thing, I guess, it that you were just mentioning, you know, you were in Sicily, and then, of course, that goes back to the secret society, right? Where the mob was birthed. So how did that come about? Just, you know, overall.
Yeah. What I found was when I was doing my research And obviously, when you're on the streets and you're committing crimes, you don't know the history of the mafia. We just know the history of our own lives and what's going on today. You know, the criminals aren't the most intelligent people, and I wasn't when I was a criminal. So at some point or another, when I'm doing this deep dive into research, I realized that a lot of the books that discussed the early origins of the mafia would give a word or two about it and move on. And it always frustrated me. When I read about the Roman Empire, for example, I don't want to start with Julius Caesar. Or if I read about the Greeks, I don't want to start with Alexander the Great. I want to know how it all began. And nobody was giving me that information. So I went deep into the Middle Ages, into feudalism, and I uncovered for the first time where exactly and how exactly the mafia came about in Sicily. And it's so much, it covers the first few chapters. It's difficult to give your listeners that in a nutshell. But basically it did stem from feudalism in ancient Europe, and it stemmed from secret societies that were put together when across Europe. This new wave of democratically elected governments wanted to overthrow, democratically elected governments and overthrow the ancient regimes. They created secret societies. For example, we know the Jacobins in France, but there were other ones across the continent and especially in Italy. And when those secret societies achieved their ends and overthrew monarchies, they were dissolved, and the mafia seems to have taken a lot of the things from those secret societies when they needed the most. And I urge all of your listeners, to read it if you're interested in how the mafia really came about. And it goes into the family structure in Sicily. It goes into the very unique socio-political conditions in Sicily. That's the only place this could have really, really come about is Sicily, an island like Sicily that was trampled on by so many different governments and empires throughout the ages, and they developed their own way. And I get deep into it. I even uncover for the first time where the exact word mafia came from. Nobody had ever done that before. I'm fascinated by etymological roots, different words, where they come from. So I was able to dive into that a little. And then I move on to the fast stories, the gruesome tales and gory tales and the intrigues and the politics behind certain moves that mafia dons made. And I tell you why a mafia don may have been killed, what he did wrong, and why another one might have lived, and what he did right. So I find that always interesting, sort of like based on the idea of Plutarch's Lives, when he would profile the Greco-Roman lives and their vices and virtues and tell you how they did things right or wrong. I did the same thing with the mafia bosses throughout the book. I go deep into it. So far, as I said, I've been very, very pleased with the feedback I've been getting. People are happy with it. And it took me 7 years to going on eight now as I prepare volume two for publication at the end of this year.
Yeah, no, perfect. And again, congratulations on all that. Talking with our guest today, Mr. Louis Ferrante. He's the author of Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. And this is the first of three. So I would encourage everybody to pick the book up. You can get it Simon & Schuster, Amazon, wherever you get good books. You'll be able to find Lou's latest book there. And if you're driving and you can't write this stuff down, don't worry. Be safe. Just drop me an email and I'll make sure I get you the name of the book and anything else that you might need if you want to pursue this and learn about the history of the mafia. One of the things, Lou, that is in my mind when I see these things is, even though it was violent and people died and were hurt and, a lot of bad things happened, one thing with the mafia was there was a code of honor. There were rules. It seemed very seldom that civilians were caught up in any unnecessary violence or injury or death. And these days it's quite different. So I wonder how you feel about the mafia, number one, what it's like today, how strong, how relevant and prevalent. And also all of the new gangs that we American citizens have to deal with, the MS-13s, the Chechnyans, the Jamaicans. I mean, you have a lot of ruthless and mm-hmm. seems to be non-caring gangs out there. So what's the difference these days?
That's a great question, Chris. And the difference is, as you said, there was a code. When Benjamin Bugsy Siegel was building Las Vegas with mafia money, he recruited the developer Del Webb, who was also part owner of the New York Yankees. And Del Webb was slightly concerned about getting involved in a relationship with Siegel, even in just a development capacity. And he said to him, you know, I can't lie to you. I'm slightly concerned about this relationship. And Siegel said to him a famous quote. He says, "Don't worry about it. We only kill each other." And that's exactly what you were saying. There was no innocent victims. They did kill each other, the mob. It was usually power struggles. The mafia has devolved into something slightly different today. That's why there's three volumes. The first is Rise of Empire. The second is Clash of Titans. And the third is Autumn of Empire for the trilogy. But there's nothing. The gangs today, there will be a time when Americans wish that they had the mafia back as opposed to the gangs today. I mean, that's a tough thing to say. I hope people don't misunderstand me. But in the sense of violence toward innocent people, the mafia avoided it at all costs. And if you accidentally killed an innocent person, you were usually killed because of that mistake. It wasn't that they had this value for life, the sanctity of human life. It was because they didn't want the publicity, the bad publicity. They wanted the American public's approval. That's why they delivered booze during Prohibition. They were giving people casinos when gambling was illegal. They always tried to keep things on the up and up. However, as the mafia devolved, they eventually did get involved in drugs, and that was a horrific thing, and that's why I trace the devolution of the mafia, how it did decline and its degenerative aspects of it as well. I do trace, and it isn't what it used to be. But once again, gangs today, they reward each other for heinous acts toward innocent people. They pat each other on the back, and it's despicable. And I think that's something that's very different from the Italian mafia, always was and still is today. The Italian mafia also, when I was young, when I was involved in the life, we protected our neighborhood. We may have done horrible things. I may have hijacked a truck. I've been accused of robbing armored cars, etc. But the people in my neighborhood were safe. If we heard somebody broke into a house in my neighborhood, you didn't have to worry about the police. You had to worry about us. You weren't allowed to break into a neighbor's house. You weren't allowed to steal a car from my neighborhood. And we stole cars from other neighborhoods, but not our own. So it was a demented, twisted set of codes that we followed. I'm not going to say this is right, but I will say that there was something that did exist, at least in our twisted minds, that did protect the people around us. We loved our family. We loved our friends. We preserved our neighborhood, and we would never allow bad things to happen in our neighborhood. While I was in a stolen car, while I was a teenager, I have an award that was sent to me by a bank manager, because as I'm in a stolen car with a friend of mine, I witnessed somebody slash at an old lady with a knife and take her pocketbook. I literally jumped out of the car, traced him down, tackled him, roughed him up, took the knife away from him, and the police eventually arrested him. And the bank manager came out and said, "Who are you? Please give me your name. I want to send you something." I thought it would be a money reward. I was young. I was a thief. What the hell? So I gave him my name, and he sent me a beautiful commendation saying the streets would be cleaner with people like you on the street. Meanwhile, I just jumped out of a stolen car a block away. I got back into a stolen car, and we drove away. But that was quite different from taking a knife to an old woman. So once again, we had a code. It was a twisted code. I do admit that. But we did have a code, and it's quite different from today, where people would one gang member might approve of another in certain gangs today who would accost an old lady like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us, your neighborhood that you grew up in, and let's just say Little Italy in New York City, how much have they changed over the years? I understand you live in Florida now, you're not up there, but how much has that changed?
Well, Little Italy, for example, I mean, down on the west side, we'll take, for example, I'm very close with Vincent Cingiganti, was the mob boss that used to walk the streets with a bathrobe feigning lunacy. There were newspaper covers with him on the cover in a bathrobe. He's very famous. He's been on a lot of documentaries, and books have been written about him. Well, I was very close with Giganti's family, and where he lived in the village with his mother, Greenwich Village in Manhattan on the west side, there was no crime. within that, you know, few block radius of where he lived. It was unheard of, because if somebody committed a crime in that area, they were thrown in a trunk that night. And he would have people hunt you down, and that would be the end of it. So here's this man feigning lunacy, talking to parking meters. When the FBI went to arrest him once, he was in the shower with an umbrella, fully dressed. You know, I mean, the guy was complete, you know, he played the lunatic role perfectly, but he wasn't so loony. He protected his neighborhood. And there was a stark change in the area when he died. I mean, I can't say it better than that. Literally, like, within days of his death. First, he was sent to prison, and then he died. But within days of him leaving the area, things began to change, and there were newspaper articles about an old lady being robbed and somebody else being robbed at gunpoint. And, you know, he kept that neighborhood. And that was sort of like the way of the mob back then. I do trace that. It's once again, it's devolved. I don't want to ever say, I don't want your listeners to misconstrue my words and think that I'm saying the mafia was ever a good thing. I'm not. But I'm saying, as bad as it was, they did have a special spot for their neighborhoods and the people around them. And that was important. That was important to protect your neighborhood. It was very important in the mob. And mafia neighborhoods were always a lot safer than average neighborhoods because of that. And the mob had to put a premium on that because they needed to be liked by the people around them. And that's why if surveillance teams came in, if FBI agents, for example, when surveillance teams came in to watch Gigante and they set up surveillance nests within the area, they were destroyed overnight. And who were they destroyed by? Not mobsters, by average citizens who said, we don't want him going away. We like the neighborhood just the way it is with him. We like a mafia don in our midst. They weren't afraid of him. They knew that. They knew how to handle their relationships with him. They wouldn't double cross him. They wouldn't hurt him. But they knew that he was there protecting them if they needed him. And it was sort of in the piazza in Palermo, Sicily. You know, you had an old man who was 85 or 90 years old, you know, in pants hiked up to his ribs with suspenders on. And he was the final arbiter of all things in that area. He was the law. And people liked it that way in Sicily. And a lot of neighborhoods in the United States liked it that way when they had their mafia dons locally. When I used to go to John Gotti's 4th of July parties in South Ozone Park, Queens, it wasn't just mobsters there. We had thousands and thousands of people, black, white, Asian, you name it, men, women, children, adults. Every sort of demographic from the community was packed into that block radius, celebrating the 4th of July with John Gotti and the mafia. Why were they not afraid to come and hang out with us? Because we were fine with the neighborhood. We were a positive thing in that regard. I'm not to say that we were a positive thing in society. Once again, I don't want to be misconstrued. I don't want to misspeak here. But the neighborhood felt like we were fine. If there was something that happened in the neighborhood, people would come to me. If somebody, it's very difficult, Chris, to go into, I don't know if any of your listeners have ever attempted small claims court, for example, if you've had an issue with your neighbor, if you've had an issue with your employer, you have to take off days from work, you have to hire a lawyer, you have to study the law, you have to file a brief, the judge speaks in Latin linguistics that you're not familiar with. It's very difficult to get relief from the courts when you're an average citizen. The courts are supposed to be available to us, but they're really not. They're available to the law, to lawyers, to law firms. They're not really available to little people. Little people have to go to people like us when we were on the street and say, hey, my neighbor ran into my car. I can't get the insurance to cover it. He won't admit he did it. I can't afford to go to small claims court. Can you talk to him for me, Louie? And I would say, sure, where is he? Get him over here, or I'll go visit him tomorrow. And I would tell the guy, if you bumped into his car and the damage is $600, pay the damage. And then the guy might say, well, he's lying. The damage wasn't $600. It's only $200. And I'd take a look. It's okay. Give him $200. Give him $200. If that's what the case is, and I'll talk to him and tell him he shouldn't be inflating it. But I would straighten it out to sort of the agreement of both parties, usually. And that was sort of like the law in my area, where we were able to do that time and time again. I get it. Somebody might say, hey, you know, I'm having a problem where, you know, I think my neighbor's fooling around with my wife, and it's going to break up my family. Okay, let me talk to your neighbor. If it's true, I'll stop it. If it's not, maybe you need to straighten out some things with your wife. Maybe you're accusing her and you shouldn't be. But I would get to the bottom of it. And people feared us enough because we were violent, and that's not a good thing. I'm not saying it was. But because we were violent, people feared us, and they usually coughed up the truth because they feared the repercussions if we caught them in a lie. So I was able to get to the bottom. Once I assured somebody, obviously, that I wouldn't hurt them. But we were able to get to the bottom of things time and time again. And I go through that in Borgata, Rise of Empire. I show how it all formed in Sicily, how it came to the United States. You could also, hopefully, if your listeners enjoy the first volume, Rise of Empire, hopefully you could pre-order Clash of Titans as well. And aside from purchasing it at Amazon or wherever books are sold, Barnes & Noble, you could also visit my website, louisferrante.com, louisferrante.com. And feel free to drop me an email if you have any questions while you're reading it. But I hope your listeners enjoy it. It traces the United States and fall and their impact on so many different things, on whether it be and Chris, they capitalize on every business opportunity in America, whether it be the faulty idea of prohibiting alcohol, the stock market crash when banks clamped down and weren't loaning money to businesses. There were only few remaining banks after most of them failed. The mafia was flush with cash coming out of Prohibition, and they lent out a lot of money to people, and they got their hooks into different businesses through that loan, through those loans. And time again, they did this when Americans couldn't gamble. Now Americans can go to any gas station and buy scratch-off tickets.
Right.
I mean, you could go to Atlantic City, you could go to Las Vegas, you could go to Foxwoods Casino in Connecticut, you could go anywhere in the country and gamble, Hard Rock Casino. But there was a time when Americans wanted to gamble, and the state wasn't providing them that opportunity. And the mafia moved in on that as well.
Yep.
So they were constantly moving in. Yeah, constantly, just like spotting areas of opportunity where the government was failing, or institutions were failing, or industry was failing. Garbage, when nobody really wanted to deal in dirty garbage, the mafia monopolized the garbage industry. And I talk about that in Volume 2. I get more into it in Volume 2 and 3, how the mafia moved in, said, well, nobody wants to deal with piles of garbage. We will. We'll pick it up. And they monopolized the industry. They had basically a cartel. And if anybody sort of, Chris, this is really interesting too, and we won't get to this till Volume 3, but a friend of mine controlled a lot of the garbage on Long Island, and it was a cartel. And you had to abide by the rules. These are the prices that we charge people. You're not allowed to undercut other people because you'll hurt the collective enterprise here. And you're not allowed to go and beat people up and undercut other people in other territories. This is your territory. You're not allowed to go elsewhere. So everybody said that that's illegal, and it was. I agree with that. It was a cartel. It was price fixing, etc. And eventually the mob went down and was taken down because of it. Racketeering indictments were dished out. And the mafia was removed from the scene. What took its place, though, is very interesting. What took its place was a monopoly, a corporate monopoly. So the mob allowed everybody in the world, if I had two trucks and my neighbor had three trucks and another neighbor had four trucks, we were allowed to still deal in garbage. And we just had to abide by the Italian mafia's rules. But you could be Irish, you could be German, you could be black, you could be Hispanic. You were allowed to have a waste removal company, as long as you abided by the mafia's rules. Now the mafia was removed from the scene. Who took over? A huge monopolistic company that bought out all the mom and pops and destroyed them. You cannot compete. You can't say, I want to, you know, have two or three trucks now. They'll crush you in a minute. It's publicly traded, and that's the end of it.
Yep.
So what's better? It's a corporate mafia now in another way. So, I mean, you could argue that the mafia was worse because they were violent and the new company isn't doing it with violence. But the new company squeezes you out and they're not allowed even to allow you to take part.
And control cost and all that comes along with it, and, you know, sponsor exactly. Major sporting events to try to polish exactly. up their image, if you will. So, no, that's an excellent example. So our guest today has been Mr. Lou Ferrante. His latest book is, one of three in a series, Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of the American Mafia. Takes you from 1860 to 1960, roughly. And then you can already pre-order the second volume of that series. So, Lou, what I'll do is I'll keep an eye out. As soon as that hits, we'll get you back on. We'll talk about the second volume, and you can give us an update on Borgata.
I can't wait, Chris. Second volume, as a teaser, gets deep into the Kennedy administration. John F. Kennedy was elected president with the mafia's help, and he appointed his brother, Robert Kennedy, as the attorney general. And the deal was supposed to be brokered by Joe Kennedy Sr., who controlled most of his, controlled his children. The deal with the mob that he made was that the Kennedys would lay off the mob. And Bobby Kennedy did not do that.
Perfect.
Robert F. Kennedy, as Attorney General, went after them.
Yeah. Great tease. So, excellent, man. Yeah, we'll dive into that more next time. So thank you so much. I know you're busy. You got a great, successful life going. So thanks for taking the time to join us. And like I said, we'll get back with you.
Thanks, Chris. Always a pleasure. And so great to hear your voice all these years later. Still going strong.
You got it, brother. Take care. I'll talk to you soon. And that does it for us. We're up against a hard break. So hope you enjoyed the program. Remember, if you're driving, as always, it's not safe to try to, you know, write things down or type them in your phone or whatever. Just drop me an email and I'll get you whatever you need. And we'll talk with you on the Morning News Express weekday mornings. And we'll be back here next Saturday for another edition of the Your Financial Editor program. This is Chris Murray wishing you and your family financial success.